Hello, and welcome to No Killing Goblins. We're the Wandering Inn fan podcast, and I appear to have forgotten how my brain works today. Oshi, how's your week been?
That's how it's been. Seriously. I've just been coughing a lot, and I don't know what is going on with me. Aside from that, it's been an interesting week because Pirate is launching 7 chapters in a week. I don't want to talk about the real world and the wars and the disasters. I want to focus on Pirate Appa's 7 chapters in a week.
Oh, I know. I am really excited for this, especially because Pirate doing one chapter a day for a week basically leads up to an end right on my birthday. And this is also the my favorite character section. So it's like a birthday present to me.
God. I just coughed up some phlegm. It's just a lot of fun whenever Pirate does these kind of things. It also is worrying because Pirate's probably the only person who doesn't worry about burnout. Everybody else does, because they just keep talking about their passion whenever anybody mentions burning out. Well, we're still planning to record this episode of Practical Guide to Evil, trying to cover it now that it's complete and it's a finished work. EE has completed it a couple of weeks ago at this point. I really want to talk about it, but I don't know. It gets my blood boiling at times, and I can be very, weird about it.
And, it's a interesting read. Now that it is out and I've had a chance to go through some of the Patreon-locked extra chapters, it definitely has added a lot more depth and flavor to a few different character arcs, so I'm finishing my reread of it, and I think that there's just actually a lot of cool series that are done that I think I would recommend to people to just try out. I know that Mother of Learning is one that Pirate themselves shouted out. There's a few other niche ones, like Unsong, which is one of the strangest little hidden gems on the internet. It's like somebody took that sort of generic urban fantasy type setup where it's like, oh, turns out magic is real, but it's in the modern day, and added what I can only describe as a Jewish Kabbalah-esque twist to the way that magic works instead of the generic Judeo-Christian, vaguely Wiccan melting pot.
I haven't really been focusing too much on web serials recently because I've been trying to delve more into the publishing industry, published works in the in the traditional medium, I guess you want to call it. I've been reading more and more about why. Okay, so here's something I noticed at the beginning, like last year and the beginning of this year, there just wasn't a lot of books published. It just didn't happen for a multitude of reasons, including what I found from another writer that I follow, Alona Andrews, is that there was a massive shortage of paper. And because of that, they literally, like, publishing houses have like a 6-month lead time, and they physically couldn't publish books, because what would happen is they'd set a date. Authors would be like really, exhausted from the pandemic, and then they couldn't meet deadlines and they had to delay, and then delays topped on top of each other, and it was like this whole cascade of disasters, and all of these books that never got published on time, and now there's like a backlog, and I kind of think there's going to be like a book tsunami coming soon, which means I'm going to be in heaven, and I need to sift. Yeah, I'm hoping.
On the subject of authors during the pandemic getting exhausted and other authors not, you get people like Brandon Sanderson who just secretly wrote 4 whole books on the side because they were bored and needed a break from writing more books, which actually feels eerily like Pirate 5 years in the future after what Pirate pulled with Grave
Song. I have many opinions on Brandon Sanderson. The most important one being, do not think
they
that
all
little
be good
video slash marketing ploy and the 4 books and he planned this shit. This isn't something that, no.
This is not the first time that he's done this, Oshi. Like I don't know if you follow him or his writing or like his personal blogs too closely, but right now the entire Wax and Wayne series kind of exists because he felt like writing a little one-off. Then he went to write one book, got stuck on writer's block, wrote its sequel, then went right back and wrote the other one, wrote a whole third book at the same time that wasn't even related to the other two. But anyways, what I was getting to is even though all this stuff is done at once, they still want to pace it out, right? So I don't think we're going to get the book tsunami exactly as much as the publishing people are just going to be sitting on completed books for a long time and just kind of letting space exist between them before they put them out.
Okay, let's get to the meat of today's podcast. What am I saying? We're starting on chapter 14 of The Wandering Inn, Volume 2, and it's the first goblin chapter of the entire thing.
Yeah, and we have gotten occasional snippets of Goblin perspective before from Rags, but I think this is like the first real has a G in it dedicated to goblins and what it is to be a goblin in a way that we just, I don't think, even could really understand before this. I love the way that it opens up, too.
The line or just the scene that plays out?
Yes, I love the line because it's like sort of a classic cliche, right? Like, soldier person wonders if today's the day they die. Seems like they ask themselves that question every day, but never did she wonder if she. It feels a little over the top, right? And then, like, it settles in. Wow, Rags is still basically like a 3-year-old, and this is genuinely just the way she thinks every day of her life is that she might die. And is it today? And you're like, oh God, is this about to be a big battle? Are like there's more fights with these other goblin tribes? Are adventurers coming after them? No. No, it's a fucking rock crab. They're hungry.
Yep, it's a common motif that Pirate uses in that they build the perspective of the person that you're reading with by building the world around them. And they use, I mean, it's not exactly uncommon from a writing's perspective to do it this way, but Pirate uses it a lot and oftentimes very well. And in the process of doing so, they build out the world a lot. Most of these kind of mini, these moments where we go into the perspective of somebody always builds out the world. In this one in particular, we find out about how goblins function, how they gain levels, how they grow up, what how they age, their attitude towards death, to the people around them. It's a really interesting way Pirate drops everything, and I enjoy it a lot, although I wouldn't read the story as much as if I didn't.
Yeah, and even for like little things that frankly nobody but me was probably asking, like the fact that light can make its way into rock shell crabs, presumably through small holes that they then use to see out of, because I was always curious how they found prey. And then they're like, oh yeah, so it turns out there's enough light for the goblins to see coming in through the shell. Well, they kamikaze run under its shell, crawl up it, and try and stab it to death. Well, it's just, doing its best to crush them all alive. And it's like, wow, being a goblin is kind of hardcore.
It's scary, and I don't know how well established the leveling system was at this point, or more exactly how certain people interacted with the leveling system, but we begin to learn a little bit about how goblins are a little different from everyone else. There is a hint to something that's explained a little bit later in the story when Rags talks about how goblins don't level so quickly. And even when they get to like 9 or 10 years old, they're still not leveling very quickly. It's a hint to the effects of age on leveling. And I missed it on my first read through, but it makes sense now.
Yeah, no, my theory at the time, and kind of still is, like, I think it's a confluence of things, and one of them pretty clearly is, like, the age thing, and that maybe they're not as different as everyone else thinks they are. But at the time, I think there's also a matter of perspective, right? Other people often see goblins as less advanced and more basic. And goblins themselves, especially if they're in a more isolated tribe like this, might see themselves the same way. And, that perspective influences whether or not they're getting beginner classes or real classes. The entry level type child classes combined with a almost institutional social lack of self-esteem about their capabilities.
Or at least from this particular tribe, in any case. We get to look at how Rags questions the world, her place in it. Why does it have to be this? Why do I have to starve? Why do I have to be hurt? And there are moments when Rags interacts with other people. There was a telling one. You know how much I love Relk and Kilbukich. And Rags kind of follows them for a little while. There's a moment where, like, this is when I would say the first... No, let me just start over. So this is when Kilbukich kind of lays out his worldview and his reaction to the presence of goblins after he was killed by them. To him, it's Aaron likes them, let's leave him alone. And Relk is like, let's kill them, they hurt you. And it's telling. I know this chapter is mostly about Rags, but it's also, again, world building on the part of Pirate and characterization on the part of Pirate. Kilbukich thinks in very straight lines. This person I value values this other person. I can't kill the person that is valued by this person. It's very clear lines, while Relk is a lot messier. He's like, this bitch hurt my friend. I'm a killer. Let me kill her. But then he says, leave her alone. And he listens because his friend doesn't want him to do it. It's a very subtle landing of their attitudes and thought processes.
He is such a big emotional softy, Relk is. There is a sort of this shadow hanging over all of this that I don't think is really made clear, and it may not have been made clear when Pirate was writing it, about just how much, like, damage and horror the Goblin King inflicted. And you can almost feel, as through Relk more than anyone else, sort of the average person's response to these things what have killed my friends and family. And this sort of inability to separate that and recognize that Rags is just an adorable, precocious child who likes chess and would prefer not to starve
to
death.
It's hard. I don't think Pirate meant it to be. I could be wrong. And if I am, I'm happy to be corrected. But there is this reflection of, when I was first reading it, I saw the goblins more as, like, war orphans. Does that make sense? I read a lot about, like, significant conflicts and what happens afterwards is that oftentimes adults are gone. There isn't a lot of care for children. And the orphans that are left over have to raise themselves. And the usual problems that come with that, which is you turn into gangs, you become scavengers because you have to survive. There's no one to take care of. You have to take care of each other. And that leaves its mark. It's a significant trauma. The same thing is replicated for the goblins on a macro level. They're constantly hunted. They're in a constant state of war. They live in perpetual trauma. The fatalism that Rags demonstrates is a consequence of that continual and perpetual state of trauma. Mental, physical, it just leaves them in this broken child soldier-like state. And it's terrifying. If you think about it for more than 3 seconds, it's terrifying.
Oh, yeah. I see it. Oh, yeah, I see what you're talking about. I would just add that I think that there is an extra layer and angle coming down onto it where it's not just, okay, these are war orphans struggling to survive. They band together. They do awful things because the alternative is starving. Every day is a struggle for them. Every day is life or death. They all have PTSD. Only they're war orphans after a war where, effectively speaking, they are marked for, like, you know, extermination. It's not just, oh, hey, we have to struggle to survive just because the world itself is uncaring and cruel. Every other sentient being that is not them wants to kill them on sight. They are the losers of an ethnic cleansing.
I was trying to avoid that particular terminology, but yeah, that's exactly it.
I do not know how we can discuss goblins and not discuss it. And yes, it gets more complicated, because like I said, the Goblin King's a fuck.
It isn't just that. It's that goblins aren't completely helpless. It isn't exactly like they aren't treated like this for a reason. It's not a great reason, but it is a reason. It isn't necessarily something anyone has a huge choice in because it's either kill them or be murdered.
Might call it a cycle of violence.
Exactly. When you create that level of, when you, take it, sorry. When you boil down the causes for goblins being listed as quote unquote monsters, when you boil down why goblins are so used to thinking of other people as harmful to their existence, it's so terrible. Like, it's unfair. The ascent, that's what Pirate spends a lot of time building into the story, and we get to find out over time, but the existence of a goblin is an unfair existence. Nothing about it is fair. Nothing about it is right. It's not right for the people who are forced to kill them or suffer the possibility that their entire life will disappear sometime down the future because they were nice, or the goblins themselves who have no choice but to live in this state of trauma and war to survive because everyone sees them as a legitimate threat.
And oh God, I can't go into detail here, but there is this scene much later on, and I'll talk about it there, that I think so perfectly encapsulates that, and I cannot wait for several books from now when I can talk about it. But yeah, no, it's just unfair to be a goblin. It's unfair to be around goblins. But if there is one person in like this entire setting who has decided they have their own fucking standard of fairness and they are sticking to it, good and bad, it's Aaron. And I love the way that they talk about how, like, the Wandering Inn is not just food for them. It's heaven. It is the feeling of security in a world where literally they do not know what that means, almost from
Yeah,
birth.
the significance of Rags leveling up the way she does in this chapter is also important in mind. Because this is, I think, the origin story of why Rags chooses the path that she does. It's the thesis for what causes her to become a leader, for to take the Tinkerer class, to begin to take the steps to become the person that she wants to be. Because she wants to survive. She wants the people around her to survive. And she will take whatever knowledge, whatever path necessary for that to happen. And it begins to solidify with this chapter. And I think that's clearly what the point of the chapter was, to establish Rags, the person who will be making the choices that she does over the course of the story.
Yeah, and God, man, is Rags, and it's hard for me to try and put this even into words. She's such a good girl. She's such a sweet, adorable little girl, and that's all underneath like this hard as nails fucking persona that is also just as true. So maybe persona is not the right word, but like. What you said about unfairness really does just stick to it, and God, you know, Relk, I love Relk to death, but fuck
Oh,
Relk,
come on. You know that nothing in this world is black and white.
I
And
do.
Relk's attitude is never as un despite the fact the pirate does everything to obscure it, Relk's attitudes, Kilbekich's attitudes, they are not black and white. And that's why they're in this chapter, right? It's the first indications of what's going on there.
And like I said, I haven't stopped loving Relk. He's still an adorable doofus. I'm just saying, you know, fuck Relk sometimes.
Absolutely.
Like,
Yeah, I understand that. Like, you can be a douche sometimes.
yeah, and you know, sometimes being a douche involves also being kind of a murderer, I guess. But fuck if they weren't murdering murderers, and he is technically a member of the guard. And God, the situation is so fucked and
It,
complicated.
that's what I loved about all this. I, okay, I'll be fair and honest about this. I wasn't. I skimmed some of the goblin chapters when we got to the more significant goblin plot lines because I could see where the story was evolving and developing to, and all I could think, oh, I didn't want to cry anymore. I just didn't want to cry over children dying anymore. And I love Pirate, but when I heard that line from someone, a few, like I said it in the Andrea episode, war crimes, slice of life, it truly is. And I just wanted to go back to slice of life and less the war crimes.
Yeah, I'm the opposite though. The Goblin chapters, every last one of them has grabbed me. Some of my favorite characters specifically are goblins at this point, and I am always pulled in by them, their struggles, their lives, when they overcome and when they don't. I could not skip a goblin chapter if you paid me to.
You know I have a grudge against one particular goblin. The rest of them I'm good with. You know I love my I'm good with goblins in general, but there is one particular goblin that I am that stole a chapter from me that I will never forgive. And did it and I and
Yeah.
Pirate wrote that chapter just I feel, even if it wasn't true, I feel like that chapter was written to attack me. It was a cooking chapter. We'll talk about it someday. In any case, so the chapter wraps up in an interesting point as well. So Rax levels up, and then she brings her tribe out of disaster. She thinks she's gonna do well, and they're in a situation. And then, out of the ruins, pursued by a massive suit of armor, comes a particular figure who seems to have disappeared, right?
Yeah, and I love not only the way that Pirate interconnects all these different things that are going on, like Torin, the big hole he fell into, this mysterious big larger dungeon that he may have been in. Now we have goblins and goblin memories. This is the first chapter to introduce that concept, the idea that they have some sort of spiritual genetic memory going on that is just such a cool little mystery of the mystery of goblins, just a teaser, and it all comes together with Rags going to said thing, with Torin coming out of said thing, and then boom, we have diverging paths suddenly slam back together again.
That's exactly what it is.
Also, it's very fucking funny at
Oh,
the
God.
end. Fucking, I'm picturing like that sort of classic gag, Rags and Torin look at each other, look at the thing, look at each
Okay,
other.
okay.
Both of them scream, only instead of Torin screaming, it's just a rattling clacking, and then they all
Okay,
run.
pause for a second. I know that the scene itself is funny and Pirate framed it really well, and despite the obvious danger and stuff, I got a nice chuckle out of it. But you know my opinions on pirates overusing the same prose with everything. This was a look chapter. Oh, Pirate does this so often. He looks at her, looks at him, looks at her, like, Enough with the looking. People can do other things than just look. That's all. This is the only time I will mention it. Or maybe I'll mention it 30 times, and this will be the first time I say the only time I'll mention it. But there it is. So let's get started with the author note. So Pirate says, "So long. Who said I was running out of steam? Me? I'm an idiot. I like was this this was a long chapter. This is one of the first like what I would consider Pirate writing to their usual length. They do double this sometimes, but that's because that's over a few days. And this was the first real long chapter. I loved it. I was really excited.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't feel that long, but in retrospect, it definitely, I don't know, it disappeared into the rest of them. I'm not gonna lie. By the time I got to here, I was going through 4 or 5 chapters every time I had a spare minute to pick my phone up. They.
I guess for me, I started noticing the uptick in both the quality and the length right around here. Not. I think it was like a chapter or two before this, but I noticed that the pirate was being more deliberate with the mixing of perspectives and littering things, and I was enjoying it. Did you see any comments that you want to talk about?
I did had seen one specifically that stuck out to me, which is Pirate clarifying that the Goblin King was only really 26 years back or so from the current day.
Is that still true today?
Yeah, that's about
that's
right.
still true. And also stating that Sira is only in her 60s. 60 years old. Sira is 60 years old. Like, it's hard to picture Sira at 60 years old.
I mean, it is, but it even came up as a plot point in the first book, right? Where they're like, yeah, technically Ciri is like the oldest, most experienced person around here. If she's down for this dungeon crawl, I'm down for this. Oh God, we're all dead now. Like, it had been mentioned before, but it's always hard to get because Ciri is just such a giant fucking child sometimes. In a good way, not in like a petulant way.
In a good way. The there is a comment from a Tim. Pirate Appa isn't Rax level a bit too high? He breaks down. I assume Tim is a he. Correct Tim if you want to come and correct me from 2017. You're welcome to. Scavenger class, warrior, mage, tactician, leader, tinker, and in total. Her levels are 32 to 33. Somebody noticed that Drax is unusual.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not wrong to say that Rags is unusual. Rags is. I mean, there's a reason why Rags is the goblin who got chess, and it's not because Rags is stupid.
It's not just that, it's the fact that for most goblins, as she was saying in the chapter, you don't get a lot of levels. But there is a lot of different classes that she has. And you start to wonder, why is Rags getting so many different classes? And why is she getting all of these classes? And how many skills does she? What is going on? Is she like everybody else? No. And it's a real big, like, obvious hint to the depth of Rags and the plans Pirate has for her. I
Yeah.
mean, the very fact that she even gets a perspective of her own was enough to like clearly indicate she's going to be important. But yeah,
Yeah, although
that's a narrative thing.
I also think that it's kind of funny though that they thought that like that added up to being on like a similar scale as Relic. As like the best way I think of to put this is don't think of it as total character level. Like that matters a little, but it really doesn't matter that much. High levels in specific classes, and also just being good. That's one thing that I feel like the series does a good job of expanding on over time. Levels are great, but it also helps to know what the fuck you're doing. I don't really, this one did not have a whole lot of comments or commentary on it myself that I notice.
Okay, so that was it for the author note and the comments. So we're gonna move on to chapter 15 of The Wandering in Volume 2.
For anyone following along on the table of contents, we are skipping MR for now. That's its own special episode,
Which
probably
will
next week.
probably be coming next week. We're gonna have a special guest and we're gonna take the time to think about it. It will be a spoilered episode, so for fresh readers, you're gonna have to skip it off, at least for the audio, because we're gonna try and talk about context and take the time with it.
Yep.
It's not the episode. I guess we can preview this just a little bit. The subject matter is one that I wanted to take some time with, and Dragonus felt the same as well. So we're trying to get past it with care, you know.
Yep, much like Pirate has tried to handle it with care, we're trying to talk about it with tact.
Okay, so chapter 15 starts off with Riku. I don't know who Riku is, but Riku's delivering is a blue-haired girl who's delivering a potato with a green sprout coming out of it. The potato, which is bigger than a baby.
Oh, God.
What the hell? What happened to the potato? What happened to these potatoes?
I met and interacted with a couple-day-old newborn a few hours ago, and now I actually have a really solid mental measurement of a potato about two babies big,
I
and it's
know! Ugh.
horrifying.
It's horrifying! Like, honestly, though, it would be really great for, like, probably we could size it properly and I could make bricks and then use the bricks to make really good hash browns and then.
And it's a horror potato too. Like Ryoko's like, I could feel my backpack moving the whole time. It was growing, it was shifting, and I'm like,
Ew.
I'm running a horror campaign right now, and I can almost feel like I need to find a way to work this potato into it.
Now I'm picturing the Mandaroga from the Harry Potter movies, where they showed like the little baby.
The Mandragora.
A Mandragora, sorry. Ew. Ugh. Okay. Anyway, so that's where it starts off, and it's a Ryoka chapter, and we're back to Ryoka. She's doing some deliveries and keeping her name out of the mix. Apparently that's what she thinks is necessary to hide her existence.
I mean, I don't even know how much hiding she's really doing. I do think it's interesting, though, that when she's thinking about names, she's thinking about how Riku sounds almost Japanese, which I think it is actually Japanese.
I'm not so sure about that, but we can Google it. Let's Google it.
I mean, I can think of at least two JRPG characters named Riku, even if the spelling's not always exactly the same, so.
Oh, you know what? There was the Final Fantasy character.
I mean, well, one of them's a Final Fantasy character, one of them's a Kingdom Hearts character, so also Square Enix.
Does this mean pirate was just like went, oh, I need a Japanese name. Let's just oh, Riku. Okay, that sounds like Ryoko. Final Fantasy. Yay. I wonder if they enjoy Final Fantasy or if it was just like a reference or unintentional
I
reference.
mean, Pirate is in, I think, the right gaming space. I don't know. I don't think they've ever talked about Final Fantasy.
Who knows?
Regardless, it's interesting. It also leads to a funny line about how there's also a place called Wales around here, so who knows?
So there is a line that comes up a little while down as we're like recapping the kind of shit that she's been through, the contract she took with Terry Ark, and the way she got past the blood fields and all that stuff. There's a line that comes up that's very important to me, to my heart. She says, "The lack of libraries in this world is offensive." There's an asterisk, and they talk about public libraries and wealthy nobles having libraries of their own books. But it is super offensive how a world that is so dependent on levels and so dependent on knowing things about leveling and classes and how to get them, somehow no one thought that a public library system, at least no one in this region thought a public library system was worth funding.
I mean, I will say again, it's almost like the leveling system makes ideas like that feel counterintuitive, so people don't invest in them.
How is it counterintuitive? Everybody needs to know how to level. They
Well,
have a book of levels.
they do, and presumably, like, that exists, and some people talk about it more than others. God, when it's brought up the first time, it feels almost religious, and then. You know,
It
the
does
Book of
fade,
Levels is
yeah.
a weird subject. Anyways, because it shows up kind of, but then doesn't. What I'm saying is the ability of skills to bridge knowledge gaps, and the way that it works out almost feels like it's deliberately encouraging a world and a system based on classical apprenticeship and guild type models, and less on large stores of public knowledge.
Which I could understand, but having a basic one rule school system with some information dissemination through books or even storytellers, or you would think there would be a leveling class that's all about disseminating information, like and they grow powerful the more information they disseminate. So
I
why
mean,
wouldn't that exist? I don't know.
this is unfair because that does exist, and I think it's a spoiler to go into too much detail about it, but
What? Wait,
when
well.
someone hears about it, their first immediate thought is to complain about, well, I mean, taking levels in student feels counterintuitive. You're wasting some of your levels. Like,
I guess.
and I don't know if I agree with that myself, but like, that is a thought somebody has in universe when they see a school. And I won't go into detail past that, but like, there are reasons why, like, these things happen this way. It's not just an accident or like.
Okay, I understand there are reasons, but I'm talking about this from maybe my perspective, living in an industrialized society in a world without magic. The idea of not properly, like, education is the key to everything in our world. And the idea of any system that doesn't appreciate the accumulation of knowledge, doesn't recognize the power of the accumulation of that knowledge, the power in the accumulation of that knowledge. This is when, this is why I want to talk about it. This is when my, like, my internal nature was going like, this world is stupid. Where's their curiosity? Where's their science? It's not fair. Pirated will, of course, balance it as time goes on. But here is where I had that moment of, what the fuck is wrong with these people?
Oh, yeah, no, I agree with you. It's anathema to me. I've lived and spent too much time in libraries in my life to think about the idea of a world where there just aren't. But it at least makes sense to me how it wound up that way. And I do appreciate Ryoka's agreement that it is kind of offensive. Also, it's still interesting to me tracking the internal asides that Ryoka has going, that are still going now. I also really liked the earlier one where it's like, no, listen, I just don't like conversations with people, all right? And I don't want to talk to people, and if you sit next to me on the bus, I hate
there
you.
Is a nice, like, weird non sequitur moment within the chapter as well. Like, Ryoka's going through the mental, we're slowly being led down the crazy paranoia of Ryoka, all the things that she's doing, all the stuff she's thinking about. And we have a moment where the paranoia comes out full tilt. She takes out her iPhone and panics about the GPS.
Oh, yeah. She goes through, and I actually kind of like the train of thought where she's thinking about how can she make contact with people? Can she reverse engineer the spell? Is it safe? Oh, no, my GPS. That could be tracked. Goes to turn it off. Realizes Ryoka's paranoid ass already turned it off probably years ago before she even wound up in this world.
Because she didn't want her parents to track her, which is fair. But I wasn't even going to say that. First thought would have been, are you fucking dumb? The GPS in a phone is dependent on satellites that don't exist. It wouldn't even work.
Normally it wouldn't even work, but magic.
Oh, come on. Like, okay, you know what? We're not going down the rabbit hole of replicating the triangulation of locations when you know for a fact that they have an entirely different system to do that, that has nothing to do with this kind of GPS stuff.
No, but I don't think it's that strange to want to cover your bases. It's magic.
All right. No. I'm gonna stick with my guns and be obstinate about this. It's stupid to even worry about this. Technological stuff is something that reverse engineering technology when you don't even understand the basics of how it was created in the first place, let alone the mathematics and the science and the techniques behind it. I don't care how much magic you have. It's not going to be that easy.
Oh, well, I mean, at that point, you're just talking about the skill system is bullshit and will probably cheat and let you bypass a whole bunch of things you should have to know or understand.
Where's my flying car? Okay.
Okay, you want to, this is an unfair question. If I answer that question, there are spoilers and you know it.
Okay. You know what? For this moment, I'll let it go. But we're going to talk about this someday, okay? Okay.
Okay.
Let's move on to the fairy.
I'll just say that in a world full of magic, and you know what? Even in a world where there was a whole, like, spiel a couple chapters ago about how even magic can't do miracles, the skill system kind of can. The skill system is bullshit.
It requires...
I put nothing past this skill system.
Yeah, all right. We're rambling on about the systems and stuff and not talking about the actual chapter itself, which I'm fine with. There's more Garia, Garia, and more Octavia, and more Falls. But
and
most
more
of,
fairies.
That's the one I was getting at. That's the one that I want to talk about, is the fairies. Honestly, every time the blue text, and then the website version of the Wandering Inn, color text is used for the fairies. We've talked about it before. In this case, anytime that blue text appeared, I was like, yes, fairies, I'm gonna learn stuff. And then they do stuff like losing patience and throwing snowballs.
And you know what? Losing your patience with Ryoka and throwing something at her is probably not a unique response to the fairies, but it is a big go-to for them.
And I just love the fact that they're such petty bitches that the one particular fairy in question that's been following Ryoka constantly keeps throwing snowballs at her head. And I know I shouldn't have taken satisfaction in that, but I did.
Yeah, and like the fairies are still funny to me. I'll admit, I feel like they might wear on their welcome and get a little annoying as time goes on, but they're still laughing here. And I also like how we have a chance to sort of get back into the mode of runners and runner politics. I do think that like the Runners Guild is one of the more unique, different, and interesting things. Like a lot of games and stories and stuff have Adventurers Guild. A lot of them don't consider who delivers the mail.
Yeah, I through what's the motto of the post? Oh God, I wanted to take a second
Neither
and
rain nor snow nor sleet or hail shall something.
something. But that's not why I wanted to take a view. Like in my head, I'm going through the rant about why the U.S. political system has fucked with the post office a few too many times. It's the stupidest thing ever. But let's move along to the Wandering Inn because that's not what we're here for. So Falls and Garia take, I think they take her out for lunch.
yeah, because Garia continues to be friendly and trying to get to know Ryoka, despite Ryoka's best efforts to hate everyone in her vicinity. And I don't know what the fuck Falls is. If Falls is actually a pretty great guy, but like at this point in time, Ryoka still actively hates him. And like, I don't know why he bothers. Oh no, wait, I almost forgot. Before they do that, this is where we meet Garia after Garia gets into it with, I think, either some goblins or some bandits.
I was going to say, this is your best girl. Do you want to talk about it?
Okay, she's not my best girl. She's on the list,
Okay, fine.
but anyways, yeah, I had kind of forgotten they'd gotten into this, and you have this whole discussion about, what it means for Garia to get attacked versus what it means for somebody else to get attacked, because Garia can barely afford the healing potion. And I think this is the first time that we get a look at what the Runners Guild and the Runners Guild's, or at least Falls's interpretation of people stick together, take turns, help each other out when they have need, works for somebody who isn't Persua actively taking advantage of and manipulating the system. Right? Like sometimes you have a Garia who takes a hit to the head and needs a healing potion.
That she couldn't afford.
Yeah. And God, for a dangerous job like this, too, like.
Okay, there is a moment of inconsistency here that will always haunt me, and I can't not talk about it. We know where Garia comes from, the idea that she does not have a healing potion.
She's stubborn and trying to make it on her own.
I will take it, but I object strenuously. No child of mine is going out into the world. I don't care how much, I'm gonna sneak it into their pack. I'm gonna teleport it into their stomach, whatever it takes.
She may even have had one and used it and couldn't afford a new one after that. Like that, I think, is a real possibility, right? Like.
I'm not trying to logic through it. I'm sure there's a logical reason for why she didn't have one and why she didn't say the truth or whatever. There's lots of reasons. It bugged me. It bugged me that there was that she had parents and they weren't keeping an eye on her. That's all. And I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I this is why I should probably never have kids, because I'd be a helicopter parent, and drive my children insane. It'll happen. Mo yeah.
Maybe. I don't know, this is just weird moment where, like I said, just a few hours ago, I was holding the newborn infant, first grandkid in my family. I've known this child for 5 minutes, and I will like tear somebody to shreds to protect. It's just
Yep.
so adorable. But at the same time, like. There's a certain point where somebody's old enough to go out on their own and live their life, and you kind of have to accept it. And I think if there's anyone alive who could grasp that, It would be them.
Okay.
Anyways, I don't want to get too deep into it because the great characters we'll meet when we meet them. But
Yeah,
we'll, oh boy, will we talk about them then.
and then there's mentions of Pursua all throughout the chapter as Pursua gathers a bunch of assholes around her, and then but th there's no fight. Ryoka does seem to avoid getting into a major fight, after which she heads off to after helping out with Garia, heads off to visit the wondrous, the beautiful, the insane saleswoman Octavia. Octavia the Alchemist.
I love the way it fucking opens up.
I know. It's
I'm
that.
sorry. It is so perfect to me, the idea that just at any point in time, if you go near Octavia's shop, you just are gonna hear her screaming and wonder if the place is about to explode. And it's all Ryoka's fault.
And I love it. I love the fact that I mean, it's a traditional mad scientist. Like, there's a mix of mad scientist alchemists here, but yeah, I love that she tests her own her potions on herself because she thinks that's the best way to do it, because she's too cheap to actually figure out a better way to
Oh
do
yeah. Well, also
it.
like she's a stitch person. When the pepper spray potion accidentally gets her eyes too hard, you can just pop them out. She's not wrong either. And like there's even a crazier second step of logic to it. When you use yourself to test your potions, you're more likely to get skills to help you resist it, to make it more efficient to use yourself to test your potions. It's like if the mad scientist was a hardcore capitalist of a tight bottom line, and it's just a funny combination to me, and I can't stop laughing. That said, for all that, like, Octavia is crazy businesswoman extraordinaire, she really does have a like real, oh my god, I was about to say thread of compassion in her, and I realize what an awful pun it is, but it's true.
I will say there is a moment. Okay, so Octavia has been established as a super pushy saleswoman, and there are moments when it kind of gets flanderized a little bit. It happens. I mean, Pyre does their best to create nuance in all characters, but it does feel a little flanderization when Octavia comes around. But there's a moment that makes me think that there's a soul behind her, and I appreciate it because this is when Pyre pushes back on that thing. So Ryoka's trying to do the generous buying a potion for Garia thing, where she can only afford silver, and she's trying to make sure that Garia doesn't feel like there's charity being given to her. But Octavia says the keep it, Garia's a good kid, and she's been a long time customer of mine. I hate to see her get hurt more than she already is. I mean, there's a
Yeah.
bit of humanity, and this is what made me like, you have to look for those. Oh, Rachel. God damn, what is her, why am I forgetting her last name?
Rachel.
I had this moment where I'm connecting, like, Rachel Bloom. So there's a song Rachel Bloom did in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend called Love Kernels, and it's all about the drip of like little things that keep people stringed along in romantic relationships. And I think of my love for books like that. Empire has this very good habit of creating all of these tiny seedlings of characterization that show you that there's depth to the character, but only those seedlings. And you gotta like savor those tiny seedlings until Pyre finally begins to reveal the totality of the character.
And there's a delightful little way that, like, you can feel that it might be undercut a little because, you know, tell the other runners too. Even in this, she's thinking, okay, I can be compassionate, I can give this potion away, and I might be able to secure more runner business in the long run through it.
Yeah, it's still true to the character, but it does show up the depth
Yeah,
that's within them.
I think it adds more depth that it's true to the character and doesn't feel like it's a forced moment for the sake of showing she's not all just business. Does that make sense? Like, if she didn't seem to have some degree of motive to it for how she could help make this money back, then I would feel like it would work less well as like, oh, she really does have a heart moment because it feels more in character. It flows better.
Yes. So the next significant thing, the next character that gets introduced is someone who's important to Ryoka. It's the runner who saved Garia on the road by distracting the bandits that were attacking her. Okay. How did Andrea
Valsif?
pronounce?
I forget how she pronounced it. I'm just gonna go with Valsif.
That's how I pronounce it. Valsif Godfrey is the first courier that Ryoka meets. Couriers are a big deal in the Runner's Guild. They're the highest rank that you can get. They run hundreds and hundreds of miles using skills and magic and abilities, and it's a big deal. And here's this courier, Valsif, who appears in this tiny city of nowhere and immediately saves her friend. He's handsome, he's cool. He enters the Runner's Guild and says, "Don't worry about it. I took care of the bandits. I took care of everything." And he just shakes hands with Ryoka and says, "Ha."
Yeah, he comes in, he's a badass, he completely ignores and blows off Persua, which, oh, that warms my heart. And then.
I had like a little moment of like, "Oh, yes, get that. Get her, Jade." Okay.
And then, you know what, actually, I think my favorite, like, low-key thing that he does, it's not remotely low-key, but, like, how do I put this? He's just faster than Ryoka.
He's fast enough. Oh, I love that. I love that. There's no moment where any person is allowed to think of themselves as more power. Like they can for a little while. Vire doesn't. It's always doing like if there's a bigger pond that you're sitting in, there's also a bigger pond than that with somebody else who's just as big as you. Nobody's the big fish for long. And I love it. I
Nope.
love it. It
And
does create these escalating power scales, but at the same time, most of the escalating power scales, Pirate messes with that by using different power scales. Like,
yeah, it's all really like delightfully put together, and I really just do also enjoy that more than anything else, this scene is a reaffirmation of Ryoka and her skill and her talent at running. Because, like, the courier himself is like, oh, hey, that's proper form. You know how to actually run. You don't just, put one foot in front of the other.
absolutely.
But here's the summit. Here's the stopping point. Here's where you stop. Because this is what skills do. Boom. Double step. Gone.
Yep, he's gone. He's blurring forward all the way away. We also get a hint that there's some kind of important delivery for Lescor.
Chess related too. Something about a Drake tactician.
Something's coming. Something's coming to Lescor. Pirate did a good job of setting that up here. And I just love the way the chapter ends on the word. My favorite word, one of my favorite words, fuck. It just goes, fuck! I just love that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to end a chapter. And to talk about Pirate's after chapter thought, this also marks the end of the newest chapter being publicly available. This chapter went up in public, and then Pirate's attempts to make a buffer instead turned into the one chapter ahead Patreon policy.
It's apparently there was the I mentioned again, part of the reason why we were talking why I should have brought this up at the beginning of the episode, like today's episode. The reason I was mentioning that Pirate's doing the 7 days thing, because that's what Pirate did with these chapters. Pirate did 8 days of an update every day. Holy crap, guys, 8 days.
Yeah, and it makes sense to me that every now and then Pirate says, I'm gonna do this. It makes less sense to me when Pirate's at a point where Pirate's putting out these massive word chapters. So, without talking about specific plot details, I do think that when Pirate is doing this current, like, chapter a day thing right now, in Volume 8, I'm noticing that Pirate is kind of stretching themselves for how concise and specific they can make these chapters to deliver the information that they want. And I can see why Pirate thinks this was the best way to do this, and I think that stuff like this helps make Pirate a better writer
I
sometimes.
think so too. One of the reasons why I secretly enjoy these chapters is because It forces concision, and oftentimes the best writing comes with limitations. Best creative work in general comes with limitations because you have to learn to exceed those limitations somehow to create something wonderful out of what little you have.
Yeah, and this is true even across different genres and mediums. It's a pretty famous story in the gaming community how Silent Hill is only as good as it is because they had graphics problems and had to invent the concept of the fog just to cover it up. Or you hear about, famous painters who limit themselves to only painting in one color for a period of time just because they're fascinated with it, and want to explore just that. That color.
That so the pirate does have some commentary that you make. Well, first off, there's a comment thread doing the exact same argument that we started talking about when it comes to the GPS. I'm telling you, we gotta get back to it. I feel like that's an important discussion to have at some point. But there is a comment from Pirate clarifying something during the chapter. So someone asked about the capability Ryoka has in comparison to Valsif and what double step is and how is she's possibly faster than anyone on the planet, and there's back and forth on it. And Pirate clarifies and says, "I'll jump in on this one since this might be an error in my description. You're right that double step does what it says and roughly double speed, although Val might have more than one skill, you know. Don't you know? But even if you only double it, I mean, he covered." I meant he covered 100 meters in around 5 seconds, which doubled gives Ryoka a time of around 10 seconds. It could be she runs exactly 10 seconds or even a tiny bit faster, which makes her as good as an Olympic athlete, or she's 1 to 2 seconds slower, which is college sprinter state champion fast. This is all tenuous and obviously subject to stuff. But her actual speed, a mystery for now. So the clarification being here, one, Val doesn't have just one skill. He's leveled up. There's more behind it. And two, and that implies that skills can be layered and can like max out a capability. And two, Ryoka's Olympic level.
Close to it, yeah. Like she talked about it before. Like when she's very first introduced, we find out that she is like scholarship, like state college, probably champion good. And then if you think about it, she has been running for her job nonstop as often as she can, just perfecting and bettering herself. And there might be a little bit more to it than that, but it all makes sense. Kind of like how, Erin talks about how before she got here, she was, and I consistently think she's downplaying it, just pretty good at chess, went to a few tournaments, was all right. But like as she is now post like game with the Antinium, I think she is approaching something like if she was dropped back into the real world, she'd be women's international master bordering on grandmaster good. Like,
Okay.
I like this feeling like the characters are growing past what we're initially sort of presented to them as in these subtle ways.
Okay, so to wrap up, there is a more businessy side to this where Pirate does discuss the number of people who visit the site and there and stuff, but all of that is in service to something. A person commented about posting Pirate Abba's web serial in more than one place. That time it was just Railroads and Top Web Fiction and Goodreads and the base site. And I've been the survey that was recently done, the assistant that Pirate hired posted about how the audience skews heavily masculine, male-centric, that because the platforms are male-centric. This is all in service to saying, would you have read The Wandering Inn if it was on like, I don't know, AO3 or Wattpad, where they have all the middle grade and high school romance fiction stuff.
Probably. Like I'll
Okay.
admit like so to me this is sort of asking a weird question because when I was in middle school and high school I was all over sort of the Wattpad of its day and fanfiction.net and all that. And then after a certain point and I the only way I can think of to describe this is you kind of associate that stuff with more entry level, low level, like people learning to write and often experimenting with other characters and weird shit. Like I've read some funny Wattpad stuff that I can only describe as fan fiction for real human beings, and that is where I draw my line. But given how I found this, like in general, and the recommendations I got for it, yeah, by the time I came along, I would
I
have read
think
it
more about
anyways.
how. I'm going to start that again. I think a lot about how people are introduced to The Wandering Inn, because it does influence who is reading The Wandering Inn, and thus what is being written in The Wandering Inn. And if I just would love to see more diversity in terms of gender balance, because it's a great story, and the Discord is so filled with like women who talk about it a lot, and then I go out there and realize, oh, it's not really reaching or permeating to everyone in a fair way. And it bugs me. Honestly, it bugs me. And I'm a dude, and I probably shouldn't be talking too much about this, but yeah, it bugs me.
I mean, if it interests you and it bugs you and it's something you want to talk about, it's something you should talk about is
Oh, yeah,
my
definitely.
stance on that. But at the same time, I just want more people to read The Wandering Inn. I don't really care if it's more men, women, this, that, the other thing. I want every human being alive to lay eyes on this story. But that's just me, like, you know. If it matters to other people and it's important to them, then obviously that's value and that's important. But to me, I just want more. It doesn't really matter who.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's about getting more readers, and I was like, I love this. There's gotta be lots of people who will read this, and I'm trying to figure out ways to get more people to read it. The other point of, talking about this for me is that we promised every week to have a question for our readers, whether we get email or not. Mike, and since you did last week's question, I'm gonna do one this week. I wanted people to think about the variety of classes in that are represented and the unique way that they're represented. It made me think a lot about what would I really want from the world, and what would I really want to be. I could ask the simple question of what class would you want to be, but honestly, think about it and think about what you want to be. What trait or aspect is inside of you that you would want to be expressed? If you could be a painter, if you could be someone utterly different, if you knew that you could exist in a world where that creative part of you, that bit of you that never gets expressed properly, could truly be expressed, what class would you choose? What would you choose? For me, it would be shapeshifter, because I know it's a magical class. I know people are going to be like, it's fantasies, but that it isn't about the magic for me. It's the ability to experience literally being something else, to be a bird, to be a tree. I loved Deep Space Nine back in the day. I don't know how many people will know what that is, but it's Star Trek. And in Deep Space Nine, there is a character named Odo, and he's a changeling, a specific race that shifts form. And for them, the epitome and essence of who they are is their ability to experience and live in different states of being. And for me, that sounds not just fascinating, it's freeing. You can be anything, literally be anything, and just change and grow, like become a part of the world and understand it in ways that no one else can. I love that. Is there something like that for you guys out there? Maybe you don't think too deeply about it, but I did. And if you do think deeply about it, what would you take?
You know, to answer that question for myself, because I do find it interesting, and we haven't gotten to that point yet, but I did rowing in high school and some cross country stuff, and was a fairly athletic and interested person. Like as we speak now, I'm training and trying to lose weight to get back and like do something like the Appalachian Trail. My immediate thought is I could see myself being interested in a class like the runner. It's something that I could see myself wanting to do and wanting to be more like that person again, combining well with how much I loved being able to zone out and just see the world when I did truck driving. But beyond all of that, the self-discipline and the self-mastery and training of the martial artist as a concept, I think really
I
appeals to
would
me, and
love
I'd
to
love to
see
see
that
how
too. Okay,
martial
so
artist and
that's a
runner
fascinating
would pull
concept.
together
The idea of physical
myself.
classes in this world being able to exceed what even is technically possible for physical classes. Like, you're running at, they talked about double step in the chapter and running faster than a car could possibly do, very much superhero style, the Flash style. You have to imagine that being that it sounds great, but it's just one expression of what somebody desires, right? That's what the whole class system is about, is finding the desire and then exploit, well, the class system exploits it to force you to do things that are impossible so that it can gain more power and sort of develop you into this superhuman, super being, Uber, Nietzschean, I don't know, whatever description you want to use, being. Well, so if we ever get any responses, I'll get into why it was so fascinating for me. And yeah, anyway, thanks everybody for listening. We've been your hosts, Dragoness and Oshi. Say bye, Dragoness. Bye,
Bye,
everybody.
everybody.
We'll see you next week.
Good night.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins. The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.